It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Russia orders Ukraine to prepay for natural gas, and a massive blast levels historic Syria hotel. I'm Bill Michaels reporting from Washington. Russia has ordered energy-dependent Ukraine to pay in advance for all future natural gas deliveries as the cash-poor Kiev government struggles to maintain economic and political stability. The Russian Energy Ministry says Ukraine missed a Wednesday deadline to pay down a $3.5 billion energy debt and said all gas sent from June 1st will require cash in advance. It remained unclear late Thursday what impact the prepayment edict will have on the European Union. Russia supplies about 30% of Western Europe's gas needs, with about half of those supplies passing through Ukraine. In another development, pro-Russian separatists in the eastern Ukraine regions of Donetsk and Luhansk said they will go ahead with votes Sunday on whether to declare independence from Kiev, despite calls from Russian President Vladimir Putin to postpone the votes. And follow this developing story at voanews.com. The head of the UN agency overseeing Syria's chemical weapons destruction says the last remaining 8% is in a dangerous and inaccessible area. Sigrid Kaag told reporters after a closed-door Security Council briefing that 16 barrels are all that are left before 100% of Syria's stockpile was destroyed. Meanwhile, the head of Syria's main opposition group, Ahmad Jarba, said his talks Thursday in Washington with Secretary of State John Kerry and other top officials will bear fruit for the Syrian people. Secretary Kerry said the coalition is a moderate opposition group committed to protecting the rights of all Syrian people.
Now, we have obviously an important meeting today with the Syrian opposition coalition, and I'm very pleased to welcome to the department someone who understands better than anybody the stakes in the struggle in Syria and the fight against extremism. President Jarba and I have met many times. We've had difficult moments in this journey, but we are committed to do our part to support the moderate opposition in its efforts to provide a legitimate voice to the aspirations and hopes of the Syrian people.
Militant Syrian rebels are claiming responsibility for blowing up the 150-year-old Carlton Hotel Thursday in the historic city of Aleppo. Pakistani authorities have decided to release on bail an FBI agent arrested for carrying ammunition while boarding a flight headed for the capital. Sharon Bain has this report from Islamabad.
An FBI agent arrested earlier this week for trying to board a plane with bullets and a knife in his bags has been granted bail. The agent was getting ready to fly from the southern city of Karachi to the capital, Islamabad, when he was stopped on May 5th. His laptop and other equipment were confiscated. U.S. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki on Wednesday confirmed the American's arrest.
This individual detained is an employee of the FBI who was on a temporary duty assignment to provide routine assistance to the legal attaché at the U.S. mission.
She said Washington was working closely with Islamabad to resolve the issue. Sharon Bain, Islamabad.
South Sudanese rebel leader Riek Machar has arrived in Addis Ababa for his first direct talks with South Sudan's President Salva Kiir since fighting and ethnic violence erupted in December. Machar arrived in the Ethiopian capital late Thursday. President Kiir is expected to arrive today for the start of the talks mediated by the East African bloc IGAD. Negotiations between the rebel and government delegations have dragged on for several months with little progress. Gunmen have shot and killed the intelligence chief for eastern Libya. Authorities say Ibrahim Sanusi was killed Thursday as he was traveling in his car in Benghazi. Libya's central government has been struggling to control armed groups and militias made up of former rebels who helped oust Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. The situation remains especially unstable in Benghazi, the scene of a deadly suicide bombing earlier this week targeting security forces. Many countries closed their consulates in the city after Islamic militants killed the U.S. ambassador and three other Americans there in 2012. For more on these stories, visit voanews.com. From Washington, I'm Bill Michaels, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Friday, May 9th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. It appears South Africa's ANC will win another mandate to lead the country as the final results of Wednesday's election are set to be announced today, Friday.
In the 20 years of the ANC government, the ANC has been able to impact positively on the lives of the poorest of the poor. And that is why they trust the ANC with their vote.
Keith Koza is communications manager and one of the spokespersons for the ANC. A Nigerian official says the abduction of nearly 300 schoolgirls is a crime against humanity. We will spotlight Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau. And South Sudan's two warring leaders are expected to meet today in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa.
We are very glad that in the next few days, our principals, you know, Dr. Riek and Salva Kiir, will be meeting to give a push or a blessing to the ongoing peace process in Addis Ababa.
Goy Duyol is spokesperson for South Sudan's rebel delegation. A Senegalese peacekeeper gets the UN's Courage Award, and the UN says half of the hundreds of millions who still lack access to drinking water are in Africa. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South Africa's Independent Electoral Commission is expected to announce official results of Wednesday's presidential and provincial election today, Friday. With about 90% of the votes counted as of late Thursday night, it appears the ruling African National Congress, ANC, is poised to get another mandate to continue its leadership of the country despite allegations of corruption leveled against President Jacob Zuma and complaints that the Party of Liberation from white minority rule has done very little to help the country's black majority. Keith Koza is communications manager and one of the spokespersons for the ANC. He tells me the vote shows that South Africans trust the ANC not just as a liberation party, but as an organization that has positively impacted the country's poor.
The ANC is doing very well. We are returning back into office with impressive margin throughout the other provinces. We are unable to take the province that was run by the DA. They managed to show a good performance, and they're retaining it with about 56% of the vote.
Why do you think the ANC is able to do this well, despite all the other problems that people think that the ANC has?
The ANC, remember, is a former liberation movement that is running a third world country, a developing economy, which has problems that are typical to all other developing economies. But what is important is that in the 20 years of the ANC government, the ANC has been able to impact positively on the lives of the poorest of the poor. And that is why they trust the ANC with their vote.
There are those who say that the ANC cannot continue to live on its past image as a liberation party, that it has to do more now to impress the majority of South Africans who feel that not much is being done by the ANC to move the country forward.
There has been a view that has been articulated by the opposition and the media to some extent, which is not real. If anybody had been to South Africa during the World Cup, they would have told that South Africa is a well-developed economy. The quality of life of our people has improved. We're talking about a situation where in the past, less than 200,000 people, young men and women, could not access university. Under the ANC, close to over 700,000 access universities annually, which means it has impacted greatly on education, literacy, and other development levels in terms of further education and so on. So the ANC has done a lot.
Can we say that although with the ANC up, according to provincial results, by 63% of the vote, is it true to say that the ANC will be a winning party, but a party that has been bruised up? And what lessons can the ANC learn from the elections?
All the things that have been said about the ANC, about corruption, they're not true, by the way. The ANC has been fighting corruption because what we inherited in 1994 was a largely corrupt government that was run by the apartheid government. The opposition has ignored that because they want to politic, and for them to gain power, they had to project the ANC negative.
Keith Koza is communications manager and one of the spokespersons for the African National Congress. He spoke with me from Johannesburg. An advisor to Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan says the abduction of the schoolgirls and the increase in violence by the Islamic militant group Boko Haram are crimes against humanity. Ruben Abate says security personnel promised by the U.S. administration will soon arrive in the country to help Nigeria find and free the schoolgirls. Abate tells reporter Peter Clotty that the Nigerian government is grateful for the international community's support to find and free the abducted schoolgirls.
The Nigerian government has received offers of assistance from the international community. Some were direct offers, others were involved the Nigerian president himself requesting for support. We have the United States offering to support Nigeria to send a team of experts, intelligence and security experts, to assist with the search for the girls. So there is a meeting of minds in terms of what the international community feels. There is a sense, a shared sense of outrage within the international community about this crime against humanity, because clearly the abduction of the girls, the threat to marry them off by the terrorists, is an affront against humanity.
The U.S. help, when do they arrive and when do they begin work, if I may ask you?
Well, I mean, I don't know whether it will be proper to give the details on air because we are also dealing with security operations. But I can tell you that from the tone of the conversation between Secretary of State John Kerry and President Jonathan, there was clearly a sense of urgency that this is not a task that can wait. So there's no doubt that the Americans, if they are not already in town, they must be on their way, because this is not just the first time Nigeria and the United States will be collaborating. Nigeria and the United States have always collaborated in many ways in the fight against terror. At all the times that President Jonathan met with President Obama, the issue of the fight against terrorism has always been one of the issues of discussion between them.
There have been criticisms of President Jonathan's administration, with people saying that the administration, and for that matter, the state government there, did not particularly move fast enough to trace these young women abducted by this terrorist organization. What is President Jonathan's response to such criticisms?
When you consider the kind of psychological trauma that the affected families are going through, then you know that the demand for urgency in putting an end to the nightmare is understandable. But what President Jonathan has continued to point out is the commitment of the administration, the determination of the federal government, and he has called for the cooperation of the parents and the guardians, because to deal with this peculiar challenge, security challenge of terror, requires concerted action, requires collective commitment, providing leadership in mobilizing not just state resources, but also the Nigerian people, to see that at this moment, we must all be united.
Ruben Abate is advisor to Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. The kidnapping of nearly 300 girls from a secondary school in northeastern Nigeria has vaulted the leader of Boko Haram into the international spotlight. Viewers and Look has more on Abubakar Shekau, the man who transformed the sect into a jihadist army capable of carrying out brutal attacks.
He's been portrayed as a bloodthirsty madman and as a highly intelligent and fearless leader. And that's just according to the man himself. Experts say there's likely truth to both depictions. Here's Abubakar Shekau claiming responsibility for the attack on the military's Giwa barracks in March in Maiduguri. It is now that you will really understand me, he said. You don't know my madness, right? It's now that you will see. By Allah, he says, I will slaughter you. And here he is in the video claiming responsibility for kidnapping the nearly 300 schoolgirls on April 14th. Do you think I will stop Allah's work, he says? I am not mad. It is you that is mad. He says, I know my religion well. I am not illiterate. He says, even if you kill me, other fighters will rise up better than me. He says, I am nothing and worthless before God, who I am working for. That is the Islam you do not know, he says. He laughed and pledged to sell the schoolgirls into slavery. His smiling, fidgety delivery has people calling him a maniac. Much of the 56-minute diatribe, which he read from papers in his hand, is his usual mix of threats and ideology. It's a belief system Shekau has been preaching since well before he traded in his traditional robes for military fatigues. He considers democracy a form of, quote, paganism, and sees Western education as a conspiracy to corrupt and destroy Islam. Boko Haram began in 2002 in northeastern Nigeria. The sect went underground in 2009 after a police crackdown and the killing of founder Mohammed Yusuf. Shekau, Yusuf's deputy, took over. By that time, Shekau had already made a name for himself as a learned Islamic scholar, a hardliner, and a persuasive preacher. A video from those days shows Shekau the preacher, dressed in white, giving a sermon. From an ideological standpoint, it's eerily similar in content to the videos he now sends into the world from hiding. This, quote, journey we have undertaken, he says at the end, is the will of God. Shekau rules out negotiation and says followers must create their own Islamic State. Shekau has been declared dead at least twice, only to reemerge. Under his leadership, the group has broadened its international ties and carried out attacks in Nigeria, ranging from suicide car bombings to assassinations. Muslims, Christians, civilians, military, no one has been spared. And look, VOA News, Dakar.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Friday, May 9th. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. South Sudanese President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar are set to meet in Ethiopia today, Friday, for talks aimed at ending their country's five-month-old conflict. Martha van der Wolf has more from the Ethiopian capital.
President Salva Kiir is expected in Addis Ababa on Friday to meet his former vice president and rebel leader Riek Machar. The men agreed to meet face-to-face this week after visits to Juba by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. The spokesman of the rebel delegation, Gojo Jul, says it is a good sign the two leaders have agreed to meet each other.
And we are very glad that in the next few days, our principals, you know, Dr. Riek and Salva Kiir, will be meeting to give a push or a blessing to the ongoing peace process in Addis Ababa. Also, we would like to see them have a roadmap on how these things should proceed.
This week, the rebels and government agreed to a one-month truce to allow aid groups to reach affected communities and to allow farmers to plant their fields before the start of the rainy season. A ceasefire agreement was signed by both sides in late January, but has been repeatedly violated. Earlier this week, both sides recommitted to the cessation of hostilities deal after the United States imposed sanctions targeting leaders of both the government and the rebels. The sides also appear to agree on an agenda for the upcoming talks, including implementation of the ceasefire agreement, discussing a transitional government and a permanent constitution. But just one day after that agreement, South Sudan's Minister of Information, Michael McQuay, raised questions about some of the details.
We have not yet discussed with the rebels. We have not yet agreed with them on the establishment of a national unity government or a government of national unity. How can we be told to discuss the task, the size, and the time frame? We are also required to talk about a transitional national legislative assembly. Have we agreed on the transitional period, or have we agreed to set up a transitional government for that matter?
The East African bloc IGAD has been mediating peace talks since the start of the conflict. The bloc says it expects a high-level meeting between Mr. Kiir and Machar will help end the violence and killings in South Sudan. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
The United Nations has created a medal to be awarded to a UN peacekeeper and civilian staff demonstrating great courage. VOA's Margaret Bashir reports from the United Nations that the medal is being named for an heroic Senegalese peacekeeper who died saving hundreds of lives during the 1994 Rwandan genocide.
Captain Mbaye Diang distinguished himself during the dark days of Rwanda's 1994 genocide, in which Hutu extremists slaughtered some 800,000 people, mostly Tutsis, in just 100 days. The 36-year-old captain, husband, and father of two, was an unarmed military observer in the UN mission in Rwanda. Rwanda's UN ambassador, Eugene Gasana, said Thursday that in the face of evil, Captain Diang refused to be a bystander.
With no guns, no weapons, armed only with courage and sense of responsibility, Captain Diagne decided to conduct several missions, going through dozens of checkpoints held by armed militias to save hundreds, maybe a thousand, of Rwandans during the 1994 genocide against the Tutsi.
On May 31, 1994, Captain Diagne's work ended when a mortar round exploded at a checkpoint near his car. He was hit by shrapnel and died instantly. The Rwandan genocide was also a dark period for the United Nations and the international community, which failed to forcefully intervene to stop the killing. Jordan's UN ambassador, Prince Zayed Al Hussein, said the fact that no UN official at headquarters ever called the captain's family after his death can only be described as shameful.
I am absolutely sure everyone here would join me when I say we are sorry, profoundly sorry, for the way you've been treated by us here at the UN.
The award, to be known as the Captain Diagne Medal for Exceptional Courage, will be presented to UN military, police, and civilian personnel who demonstrate exceptional courage in the face of extreme danger while fulfilling the mandate of their mission in the service of the United Nations and humanity. The medal was established in a resolution put forward by Jordan and adopted unanimously by the UN Security Council on Thursday. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Two leading UN agencies are calling for greater action to provide safe drinking water and basic sanitation to more than 3 billion people. A joint report by the World Health Organization and UN Children's Fund says more must be done to close the gap between the billions who have access to improved water and sanitation and those who do not. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the launch of the report in Geneva.
Significant progress has been made since 1990. The United Nations reports almost 2 billion people now have access to improved sanitation and 2.3 billion people have access to safe drinking water. Of these, 1.6 billion have water piped into their homes. That is the good news. But the bad news, says Maria Nera, WHO's Director of Public Health, Environmental and Social Determinants of Health, is that more than 700 million people still need access to good drinking sources. Half of these people live in sub-Saharan Africa.
And more than one-third of the global population, some 2.5 billion people, they don't use an improved sanitation facility. And of them, 1 billion, they still practice open defecation.
First thing in the morning, what do I see?
A pipe. UNICEF is mounting a huge campaign with the government of India called Take the Poo to the Loo. The cartoon characters prancing about in this video are very amusing. But there is nothing funny about some 600 million people in India defecating out in the open. UNICEF senior statistics and monitoring specialist Rolf Loyendijk says a number of governments are making a real push to get the poorest members of their societies to move away from open defecation to fixed place defecation.
The way they're doing that is through trying to bring about a change in social norms, that it's socially unacceptable that people practice open defecation. And that approach has been very successfully used currently in more than 80 countries.
The report notes poor sanitation and contaminated water are linked to the spread of diseases such as cholera, diarrhea, dysentery, hepatitis A, and typhoid. It notes diarrhea alone is responsible for 842,000 deaths a year due to inadequate water and sanitation. As of now, the report says 116 countries have met the Millennium Development Goal target for cutting in half the number of people who lack safe drinking water by 2015. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with volleyball. African champions lost at the Men's and Women's World Club Volleyball Championships on Thursday. In men's action, Italy's four-time world champions Trentino Diatec beat Tunisia's Esperance in straight sets in Belo Horizonte, Brazil, while Switzerland's Valero Zurich dismissed Algeria's GS Petrolia in straight sets in Zurich, Switzerland. Today, Friday, GS Petrolia play Brazil's Ceci SP. In football, Mauritania are the most improved team in the world, while Zambia has slipped by the widest margin among African countries, according to the FIFA rankings released in Zurich, Switzerland on Thursday. Ivory Coast are 21st and are Africa's highest-ranked team. Egypt is 24th, Algeria 25th, Ghana 38th, Cape Verde Islands 42nd, Nigeria 44th, Tunisia 49th, Cameroon 50th, Guinea 51st and Mali 59th. Meanwhile, African champions Egypt face hosts Sudan in Khartoum in Africa Youth Championship qualifiers this weekend. Ghana plays Sierra Leone, Mozambique engage Zambia, Lesotho encounter Angola, Tunisia meet Nigeria as Congo-Brazzaville host Benin. Elsewhere, Liberia welcome Ivory Coast, Libya play Tunisia, Togo meet Morocco, Ethiopia engage South Africa, Malawi play the Democratic Republic of Congo, Burkina Faso face Mali, Burundi challenge Cameroon, and Rwanda play Gabon. In athletics, Algeria's Olympic 1500-meter champion Taufik Makloufi returns to action after a year's absence through injury at the start of the 2014 IWF Diamond League Series in Doha, Qatar, today, Friday. His main challengers are Kenya's world 1500-meter champion Ashbel Kiprop and Djibouti's world indoor 800-meter champion Ayanle Suleiman. Botswana's Olympic silver medalist Nigel Amos runs 800 meters, while in an all-Kenyan showpiece, Olympic champion Ezekiel Kemboi encounters Brimin Kipruto and Paul Kipsiele Koech. Nigeria's Blessing Okagbare and Adekoye Oluwakemi compete in the women's 100 meters and 400 meter hurdles respectively. Kenya's current and former world champions Eunice Sum and Janet Jepkoskei run women's 800 meters as Ethiopian Genzebe Dibaba and Kenyan Mercy Cherono contest the women's 3,000 meters. On the infield, South Africa's Kotso Mokoena, Victor Hogan and Sunet Filioun contest the men's long jump, discus and women's javelin respectively. Finally, the Southern Africa Junior Athletics Championship starts in Tlokwe, Northwest Province in South Africa today, Friday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Tlokwe, Northwest Province, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday. Here's our listener mail for this Friday morning, May 9th.
I wish to express my gratitude and appreciation to President Obama of America, Britain, and every other Western world that offered to assist Nigeria in tracing out her kidnapped students. May God grant you the foresight in searching out the perpetrators and bringing home the girls in Jesus' name. I am Prince John Ishir, Obodo Cross River State, Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. South Sudanese rebel leader Riek Machar has arrived in Addis Ababa for his first direct talks with South Sudan's President Salva Kiir since fighting and ethnic violence erupted in December. Machar arrived in the Ethiopian capital late Thursday. President Kiir is expected to arrive later today, Friday, for the start of talks mediated by the East African bloc, EGA. South Africa's ruling African National Congress Party is leading the vote count in the first nationwide elections to include voters born after apartheid ended in 1994. Provisional results from the country's election commission on Thursday show the ANC with 63% of the vote, with more than half of the ballots counted. That's it for this Friday, May 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ullman, I'm James Butter saying have a lovely weekend.
Love African music.
Music time in Africa.
This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900 2000 and 2100 UTC. You can also listen to the show day or night on the internet. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. You'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa through its own music. Oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa.